Support for IPR comes from Orchestra Iowa, presenting the movie E.T., the extraterrestrial on the big screen, accompanied by the Symphony Orchestra performing the score live, May 3rd and 4th at 7:30 at the Paramount. Tickets at orchestraiowa.com.
This is an archive edition of Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe.
Buxton, Iowa was a company town, but it wasn't like any other company town. It was founded by Consolidated Coal Company in 1900, and when the company recruited miners, they did not discriminate on the basis of race. Buxton became Iowa's first fully integrated town, and the community thrived. Until the coal ran out. Author Rochelle Chase has been researching and writing about Buxton for years now. And today we're going to focus on her second book on the subject, Creating the Black Utopia of Buxton, Iowa. And Rochelle is here with me. Welcome back to the show, Rochelle.
Thank you for having me again. It's great to be here.
I do want to go back to your introduction to Buxton before we dig into this history. Can you tell me about the first time you learned about this town?
Well, it was 2008, and I was writing romance at that time, and my romance instructor, Lee Michaels, lived here in Iowa, and she says, oh, I've got this place that I want you to see. So she took me to what was left of the Buxton site, and I just couldn't believe that such a town existed in the middle of, like, farmland. And so each time I would come visit her, I would research more and research more, and I had, like, no idea what I was going to do with it, because, again, I was writing romance, right? But I just couldn't stop. And then when I moved here in 2014, I said, you know what? I'm going to write this book. And that's when Lost Buxton, the first book, was written. And then there was so much that I couldn't put in there because that was mainly photos. I thought, well, there's more I have to say. So then that's how Creating the Black Utopia of Buxton, Iowa was created.
Well,
was...
And other than sort of the rudimentary history of this town, which you were able to share in Lost Buxton, what was it that made you want to go deeper and to share more about this community?
Well, to be honest, I was looking for the answer to the why question. You know, why did the town do this or why did the company do this? Because, you know, there were other mining companies that hired African-American black miners to work in the mines, but there was not that same level of equality and opportunity for African-Americans. And so I was trying to figure out why, you know, why did they do this?
And but so they didn't have to do
didn't.
It.
They didn't. And that's why I said in the book, the mining, both mining and railroading, the railroad industries, they were not known for equal treatment of African-Americans. And so why you have this company town that's owned by both, because the railroad, Chicago Northwestern Railroad, owned Consolidation Coal. And you had this town that was the case. Well, why did they do it? So that's the question I was trying to answer. I was trying to research and get more behind the men behind the company, why the town was so different, not only from a racial standpoint, but also from coal mining town in general. And I was trying to get answers to those questions.
All right. When you start in this book, you start before the founding of Buxton. You start with another community, mm-hmm. a community I cannot pronounce. Is it Muchikinock?
Muchikinock, Muchikanik.
All right. We may not know.
Exactly. The residents called it Muchie, so that's what I like to say.
All right. So tell me about that town. That's the town that came before Buxton.
Yep, that came before Buxton. It was started by the McNeil brothers. They were from Oskaloosa, and H.W. McNeil started kind of in about 1874, started buying up coal mining, coal communities in southern Iowa, and so had about four or five and consolidated into the Consolidation Coal Company. So that's when the coal company was born. And he got his brother, Wilbur, to work on the financial side of the company. So the two of them pretty much started it. And they're the ones that started recruiting African-Americans from Virginia to work in the mines because their miners were striking.
Okay. And I was just going to say, I mean, what was behind that? They mm-hmm. were recruiting these black miners as strike breakers,
exactly.
right?
Exactly. Exactly.
And so they would bring them up here. After they brought them up, did they have jobs? Were they secure in the work even when the strike ended?
Yeah, that was, it seems like McNeil was looking into this for a while, considering this, because there were other mines that were doing this in the area, Albia Coal, Whitebreast Coal, there were some in Boone County that were doing it. So he had considered this for a while and decided it was kind of a trial, like, let's see how this works. And it worked really well. The miners were really hard workers. And so he kept doing it because the business was also growing as well, and they needed miners to work in the mines. So he kept doing it. It was a success. And at one point, African Americans made up 70% of the population in Muchie. So that's how it ended up being, blacks ended up being the majority in Buxton, because they moved over to Buxton when the Muchie mines had played out.
And were those miners brought in with equal pay?
Yeah, it seems to be that it started there with the McNeils. When they first were brought in, they weren't necessarily getting equal pay because there was a training period. So he was recruiting them, paying them $20 a month for the first 6 months, and room and board was covered while they were paired up with another miner to learn the business. Then for another 6 months, they got $25 a month, or they could get 50 cents a ton. So by then, probably by the first year, they were probably being paid equal to what the other miners were making.
Which was really unusual.
It was
for
unusual.
That time. So this, the conditions that allowed Buxton to be this remarkable community were already being put in place before Buxton was founded. I can imagine that that was an incredible draw for men and families from the South who were not going to find equal opportunity in the South.
Exactly. Exactly. And it was funny, one of the residents had made a comment that her father thought he was coming to work in a gold mine and found out it was a coal mine. You know, so my point is people were just looking for jobs. It was like, okay, I don't care what it is. Sure, this sounds good. I'm there.
Absolutely. All right, let's talk about when Buxton itself got founded, because these towns were transient. These towns would exist while the coal was there to be mined. And once the mine was played out, the town would just disappear. So what led to the founding of Buxton?
Exactly that. The mines in Muchie had played out. Also in 1881, the McNeil brothers sold the company to the Consolidation Coal Company. They were starting to look into, you know, growing operations around that time as well. So by 1897, Ben Buxton took over as a superintendent and started planning Buxton. So by 1900, Buxton was in effect. And what was also very different is he planned the town. He had hired architects to help design the town, the houses, the company store, the YMCA, some of the major buildings. And that also was very different. And again, I feel like he took what was started in Muchie and built upon it, incorporating concepts of welfare capitalism and other things to make it a bigger and better Muchie.
That seems like a tremendous amount of investment at the start of a community. I mean, he built the town, he built the housing, he built the infrastructure.
Yeah.
Was that typical of these mining towns?
It was not. Most of them were pretty much, as you said, they knew them when the mines played out, the town would dissolve. So the companies pretty much just kind of threw together the housing. There was no real thought to the planning of the town. There definitely wasn't a lot of money put into them, the average town. So yeah, that was not the norm.
Well, and you use this phrase, welfare capitalism. Mm-hmm. So tell us what that is.
Well, welfare capitalism kind of started in the industrial businesses, especially railroads. And it was kind of the first time that companies started looking at providing beyond just a salary, money for people. And it was, so let's provide these other perks, such as, you know, housing, profit sharing, YMCA, social outlets for the men, for their employees. So it was like trying to create a loyal workforce that wouldn't strike, really.
Okay, so there were other communities doing the same thing, although, again, Buxton was unusual. And you spend quite a bit of time in the book, and we'll dig into this further even after our break here, but you spend quite a bit of time in the book comparing this kind of welfare capitalism and how it was played out in Buxton and how it was played out in Pullman, Illinois. So why Pullman, Illinois?
Because Pullman was kind of considered the model welfare capitalist city, because Pullman had put a ton of money into this. He had 4,000 acres. The houses were elaborate. They had manicured lawns and fountains, and they had like a $100,000 hotel. They had a movie complex, a shopping complex. So it was kind of the first kind of real larger scale model community that had been done in about 1880 for the Pullman car workers. So that's why I was comparing it to that, because it was kind of the biggest one at that time.
All right. And was welfare capitalism something that was pretty common in the United States at this time, or was this kind of an unusual setup?
It seems like around 1880s, it was kind of starting to take off. And it was definitely by the time Buxton was in existence, it was very much throughout the railroad industry. And Chicago and Northwestern had implemented various facets of it in their business. So it would have been, the Buxtons would have been aware of it. The McNeils would have been aware of it at the time that they started their town. So it is likely that it did influence, for sure, Buxton itself.
All right. Well, we are going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment to talk more about this unique community, Buxton, Iowa. Rochelle Chase has just published the book Creating the Black Utopia of Buxton, Iowa, and we will find out more about it in just a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
Support for IPR comes from Orchestra Iowa, presenting the movie E.T., the extraterrestrial on the big screen, accompanied by the Symphony Orchestra performing the score live, May 3rd and 4th at 7:30 at the Paramount. Tickets at orchestraiowa.com.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and my guest right now is Rochelle Chase. She has published the book Creating the Black Utopia of Buxton, Iowa. This is actually her second book about Buxton, Iowa. The first was called Lost Buxton. It's about this really unusual, really remarkable community, Buxton, Iowa, that was founded by Consolidation Coal Company back in 1900, and it was our first fully integrated community in Iowa, first fully integrated, and really a community based on equality, which was so unusual in the United States and certainly in Iowa at that time. And Rochelle, before the break, we were talking about when Buxton was founded and the idea that those workers would be taken care of. This welfare capitalism idea that life would be good for workers in Buxton, and then they would be loyal to the company and they would stay at the company. So let's talk a little bit about some of the nuts and bolts of it. The housing in Buxton, what were the opportunities like for the workers there?
Well, in a lot of other mining towns, they had, like I mentioned, a little more than shacks. But in Buxton, Ben Buxton had hired someone to help plan it, as I stated. And so you had houses on a quarter acre. They had 1.5 stories. They had 2 bedrooms. They had a living room area. And so they were like real houses that the people lived in. And the Buxtons encouraged them, or I should say Ben encouraged them, to like plant gardens, you know, in the back and such. So they had real homes. There was no electricity. There was no plumbing, but they were nice houses.
And there was no segregation among the housing?
The housing was awarded on a first-come, first-served basis, so you could be living next to a black person, white person. It really just, it didn't matter.
So that fundamental integration came from the start, which again was really unusual during that day and age. Let's also talk about churches, because I think that's something that made Buxton really unique as well, because a lot of these towns, they would build one church and all the different congregations or denominations would have to share this church because the company didn't want to build a whole bunch of churches. But it was different in Buxton, right?
It was different. And also in a lot of those towns, attendance was mandatory. In Buxton, it wasn't mandatory. They had at least 2 white churches and at least 8 black churches in Buxton. Now, the churches were segregated, but residents pretty much said it was by choice. It was just because that's what they were familiar with and that's what they preferred, but it was not like forced segregation.
The company store in Buxton is another really interesting part of this story because, again, it wasn't like the other company stores in these other towns. What was the difference?
It was, for one thing, it rivaled like department stores in other towns of that size that were incorporated, in that it had 2 stories. It had an elevator that took people, you know, between the levels. It had a buyer in Chicago that would buy goods from New York, from St. Louis, from Chicago, ship them there. It had a mortuary inside. You could buy anything in the store. You could order things from the Sears and Roebuck catalog and have them shipped to the store and delivered to your house. There were delivery days where they would deliver deliver the goods based on street, you know, that people had ordered. You could buy things also on credit, which was very similar to other company stores. However, in Buxton, they did not force you to shop at the company store.
There were and that is a key difference because that company store was a huge source of income for the companies,
Exactly.
So were there other similar stores, general stores in Buxton?
There were. Hope Armstrong was an African-American there who had the largest like meat market there in town, and he would deliver fresh meat. There were at least three or four other grocery store stores there. There were over 40 independent businesses in Buxton, which also was very rare. You would not have had that in other towns. So you had restaurants, you had hotels, you had a music store, and these are just even some of the African-American businesses. You had pharmacists, you had, like I said, other where you could buy groceries. So there was like a thriving business community there in Buxton.
And you mentioned that the churches were segregated, but seemingly by choice. How about these businesses? Do we know about, you know, did people of all races and all backgrounds go to all the different businesses, or was there a black store and a white store?
There did not appear to be. Thomas Drugs, which was the white white drug store, also had some other groceries there. There were several black residents that mentioned shopping at Thomas Drugs. The meat market, Hope Armstrong, he would deliver meat to all races. In fact, he also owned property that he would rent out to both races as well. So I did not find any indication that these businesses were black or white businesses. Now, whether both races felt comfortable going to them, again, that was a personal choice, but they did not discriminate against a race.
You mentioned that the company was recruiting black miners from the South and actively engaged in that. And they realized it was working well for them. It was a great opportunity for the miners. So men and families were coming north because of this. But there was also there were a lot of immigrants coming from Europe at the same time. So was there a similar recruitment effort for immigrants?
It wasn't as formal. When Ben and I should say when the McNeils were recruiting African-Americans, they would go to the South, like for Virginia especially. And I was really excited to find this ad that's in my book. And it said, you know, colored men wanted. And it was recruiting men to go to the Virginia Hotel where they would interview with McNeil and then they would go back on the train with him. So there was more of a formal recruitment effort for black men. For others, you know, Swedish, the Slovaks, those other immigrants, it was really more word of mouth where they would come over and then Ben Buxton and folks would reach out and say, hey, do you have any family members do you know of that would like to come here? And they would say yes. And he would say, well, bring them on. So it was really more of an informal recruitment effort, it seems like, with the other races.
Interesting. And do you, I know a lot of this effort, this book, was trying to find the why. Why was Buxton this way and why did it work so well? Do you feel like the fact that people were coming directly from Europe in search of a better life, you know, people who may have been marginalized in their own countries, do you feel like that was part of the equation that made Buxton work well as an integrated community?
I think it could be a couple of things. It could be one, and this is like, again, just my own opinion. Like when I go traveling outside of the U.S., people, their perception of black people will be what they've seen on TV or, you know, what they may have been told. And so they don't really know exactly what box to put you in if they haven't had that experience. Well, I think that can contribute the other way, where you have people coming from, you know, from outside of the U.S. and they're coming here and they're coming for a better life. And so they may not have been exposed to, you know, to a certain extent, the same racist ideas.
So they
weren't
steeped in our culture of systemic racism, which was baked in as our country was founded.
Exactly. So that could be part of it. But I also think it was the fact that because people were treated equal, because there was no need to compete, that you weren't competing for jobs, you weren't competing for money, you weren't competing for things. I think, well, what is there really to really stir that up? Why is there a need to really bring racism into the mix here? And then thirdly, I think it was because a lot of the residents said that Ben Buxton and his father before him did not condone racial violence. And so there was this idea that if you could not accept that your neighbor would, you know, could be a black person or a white person, or your kids would be taught by a black or a white teacher, or you go to the company store and you're going to be waited on by a black and white or black or white clerk, and you're going to shop with black people, et cetera, et cetera. And if you can accept that, then you were encouraged to move on. So I think it could be a combination of all of these things that contributed to that.
I'm talking to Rochelle Chase. Her latest book is Creating the Black Utopia of Buxton, Iowa. You are welcome to join our conversation as well. If you have family history in Buxton, give us a call. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can also email talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Let's talk about education, because, again, this is one of the things that made Buxton so unique and such a draw for families who were looking for educational opportunities. There were a number of schools in Buxton.
Mm-hmm. There were three elementary, you know, secondary schools, and then they had one high school that burnt down in 1907. And all of their schools were two-story buildings. They had 12 teachers. And a lot of times the teachers would, they would probably have double up, you know, on the classes. But there were, and like I said, they were totally integrated, and you had, you know, black and white teachers teaching black and white students. Education was important. You also had some classes and such going on for the adults at the Y as well, in addition to, you know, the kids getting education as well. Anything from hygiene to reading. They had book clubs there as well. So, and auto repair, even though not a lot of people had cars at that time. But my point is, there was a lot of opportunity, educational opportunities, both for young people, for kids, and for adults there in Buxton.
Well, and of course, people who are students of Iowa history, you know that school segregation was illegal at that time, thanks to Alexander Clark, who really was a pioneer in so many ways. But this was a community where we saw integration in action in a way that we didn't see it in other places.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Let's talk about the YMCA. You mentioned the YMCA, and this was another, just, it was the center of the community in so many ways. Why was that?
Another component of welfare capitalism was they did not condone drinking and gambling. That was definitely prohibited in the towns themselves. So the company's philosophy was, let's give the men a lot to do, you know, a lot of recreational options. And the YMCA was one of them. The YMCA in Buxton, the company spent $20,000 to build it. It was, according to the Iowa State Bystander, actually built for African-American men. It was run by them. However, both races did use it. They had a lot of public activities, like there were two French women that ran the movie theater there in the Y on the second floor. So they would show movies every night. They also had, on the first level, they had a gymnasium, they had bathing rooms, they had reading rooms, they had a mahogany pianola there, they had oak tables and chairs and leather couches for the men to sit in. They had magazines from all over the U.S. there as well. So again, there was lots of relaxation time and recreational time for the men. And they also had lodge functions, meetings there as well. And also unions, which was another big deal. A lot of times, company towns did not allow the union to meet there if they were unionized. In Buxton, they had union meetings there at the Y. They also had the boys' Y, and this was like one of the first boys' Ys. They believe it was the first boys' Y in the U.S. there in Buxton. And they had a swimming pool on the first level and roller skating on the second level and dances for the adults. So again, lots of opportunities for education and lots of opportunities for recreation as well.
All right. So to make life good in Buxton, we have Lou on the line in Fort Dodge, Iowa. Hi, Lou.
Hi. I actually live in Perry, Iowa.
All right. So, yeah. Lou from Perry, what would you like to talk about?
Well, I'm a retired Lutheran minister, and I had a woman in my name. I'm probably not free to give her name, but her first name is Bertha, and she lived to be 105. And I got to visit extensively with her daughters, and they were from Buxton.
Oh, and, fascinating.
I just used to love going to the home because mom usually was with one of the daughters and listening to her stories. But one thing I remember that the daughters would tell me that seemed to contradict what was said, they talked about the fact that Buxton was divided. There was East Buxton and there was West Buxton, and the African Americans lived in one half and the Anglos lived in the other half. And she said, but it didn't matter to the kids. You know, the kids just played wherever they played.
Well, interesting. Yeah. I mean, we know that the housing was not divided, right, Rochelle?
Right. They did have, though, East and West Swedetown, which might have been also what you're referring to, and that was predominantly white in those areas, but black people did also live there as well. And also it was also because a lot of the people there owned their own housing as well. That was not company housing out in East Swedetown and West Swedetown. So that could also contribute to it as well. But again, it was predominantly white in those areas, but there were some African-Americans that lived in there as well.
Lou, thank you so much for calling. And Rochelle, were there cases of racism that were documented in Buxton?
I don't know about documented, but I did when I was listening to some of the interviews that were done with the former Buxton residents that Dorothy Schreeder had done as part of the grant that she did for her book. And there were people that were interviewed that used the N-word when they were referring to black people. There was one gentleman who said he didn't feel comfortable going to the Y, so he didn't go because of, you know, of it being predominantly black. There was a black person that had said his grandparents had told him not to trust white people. So again, people are coming from the various places with their own, you know, racial biases, their own prejudices. So it did, of course, exist there. But everybody pretty much said any of the violence, the murders and such that made it to the papers, that was always based on more of, you know, drinking, gambling, domestic disputes. Nobody attributed it to racism.
Interesting. Well, Rochelle Chase, we'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking to Rochelle Chase. Her latest book is Creating the Black Utopia of Buxton, Iowa. This is Talk of Iowa.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. My guest is Rochelle Chase, and she's spent the last several years researching and writing about Buxton, Iowa. Her latest book is Creating the Black Utopia of Buxton, Iowa. The community was a truly unique community in Iowa and in the United States at the first part of the 20th century. It was a town where equality was the norm, where black people and white people were treated as equals, lived together in integration. And Rochelle, just before the break, I had asked you, you know, were there cases of racism in Buxton? We're calling it a black utopia, but of course, no place is actually perfect. We haven't actually found a utopia yet anywhere, right?
Right.
But there were some really extraordinary people who lived in Buxton. And I would love for you to tell us just about a couple of people that really stand out in your mind. And I guess I want to pick one. How about Dr. Carter? Tell us about him.
Dr. Carter. Yeah. He was the first African American to graduate from the University of Iowa. I should say not to graduate, to get a medical degree from the College of Medicine. And he graduated at, you know, top of his class. And what was interesting about him is when he returned back to Buxton, he was hired by the company to be a company doctor. So he was treating both black and white patients. And what was interesting is Sister Maureen Sofranco, she became obviously a Catholic nun. She had stated that he had delivered her brother. And so that was really fascinating to me, because this was a time where, you know, black men could have been lynched just for simply looking at a white woman. And here you have her being accused of that. And here you have a black doctor that's delivering, you know, white babies. So that was pretty huge at the time. He also had a white assistant working for him, which was also something that would have been very unique at that time. But again, very good reputation in Buxton as a doctor, and was, again, very well renowned, very well renowned and very well respected there.
Is there anybody anybody else that you'd really like us to know about from Buxton?
There was George Woodson, who was a prominent attorney there in Buxton as well. And he was pretty much well-renowned throughout Iowa for being a great speaker, also for winning cases. He had co-founded the Niagara Movement, which became the NAACP, the Iowa Negro Bar Association. And he also had run for the file clerk in the Senate in 1898 and lost by one vote on the Republican Party, lost by one vote to a white man. So again, this would also have been very noteworthy for that time. Lottie Armstrong, who was another one, she was actually a cashier in the bank. And I read an article later on that had said she had also been a vice president, a director, and also a stockholder. So again, this would have been rare for a woman, let alone a black woman for that time.
Remarkable.
So that was very interesting. And I do want to clarify one thing. When I said creating the black utopia, as you mentioned, there's no such thing as utopia. The reason why I mentioned that in my title was because there's a lot of books out there that mention Buxton being a black utopia. You know, Dorothy Schweder's book did. There have been some articles that have called it a utopia. So that's really why I said that, because as you say, there is really no such thing.
Right. So Buxton was a boom town.
Yes.
And then it went bust.
Yeah.
What happened?
And about 1922 was pretty much Buxton was gone. 1914, they started having some problems in terms of layoffs. Buxton, up until that time, the men worked year round. It had a reputation for money flowing in Buxton. But around 1914, the demand for Iowa coal was starting to decline, and they had layoffs for the first time. So that was kind of the beginning of problems in Buxton. Also, the mines were starting to play out. So by 1922, there was no mines in and around Buxton. The company had moved operations out to Consul, Haydock, Bucknell, which some of the residents called New Buxton, as opposed to, you know, what they called Old Buxton, the original Buxton.
Right.
But by 1927, that was totally gone as well.
So Buxton is a ghost town now. There are a few remnants.
Yep.
When you wrote Lost Buxton, you started hearing from a lot of people who had ties to Buxton. Tell me about that.
Yeah, it was really fascinating. And even today, like with the new book, as I'm out speaking, it seems like every time I go out, someone will say something about, oh, yes, my great grandmother, you know, was from Buxton and she talked about what life was like, or I wish I'd asked more questions, you know, that sort of thing. But I had the pleasure of meeting Catherine Beverly, who was interviewed for the Iowa Public Television documentary that was done. And she was
back in 1979?
Yep. And she's 104 now. And she still remembers her time in Buxton as well. And she just talked about, you know, she says, everybody asked me, you know, was it really that, you know, was it really all that from the standpoint of the integration and the equality aspect? And she's one of the others that have said, yes, it was. And that I did not experience discrimination until I left Buxton. So a lot of people just have stories about just how amazing the African Americans have stories about how amazing the town was. In terms of the other residents, you know, the white residents out there, they were like, yes, it was a great town, but there's not that same level of passion around it. It was just another town to a lot of them.
That felt like any other town
exactly.
Where they could live. You've had a very high profile person lately talking about his connections to Buxton, Iowa, Senator Cory Booker. His family came to Iowa because of Buxton, right?
Yep. They were from Alabama. His great grandmother and her 9 children, they came lived in Buxton. And that's just been fascinating, not only from that perspective, but also that he's kind of helping to raise the awareness of Buxton as well, because I feel like, yes, this is an Iowa story, but this is bigger than Iowa. You know, this is history for everyone. And he gave a great quote about Buxton in that he said that it's my history, our history, great American history. And I thought, you know, that sums it up to me.
So what do you think the legacy of Buxton was at the time? We'll talk about what it may be today, but after Buxton went bust, do you think it influenced life in Iowa?
You know, I would like to say yes, but I don't really see any lasting, I guess, impact that I guess it had. You know, when it pretty much closed down, you know, they literally did shut the town down. They dismantled all the houses. They sold the housing off for scrap labor, or people could actually, you know, rebuild the houses elsewhere. They sold off the land. And so people just pretty much scattered wherever, you know, wherever they could find jobs. And so other than, you know, the impact that it had to people who lived there, like some of the Black people that lived there and they went elsewhere, and they, like, even in Des Moines, you know, a couple of them had said, you know, hey, like one of the teachers could only get a domestic job. Mm. One of the guys who had been making great money mining, you know, he was offered a job doing shoe shining. A lot of those people said it was like they were not going to accept that. And, you know, they went to school to learn other, you know, trades and got better jobs. So it definitely feels like for the people that lived there, it had a lasting impact on them and their experiences after they left there. It stayed with them. But in terms of a bigger impact, I haven't really been able to find that in terms of, okay, here are some companies that, you know, emulated Buxton and did some of the same things, or, you know, here's some people that carried on that aspect of integration and equality. So I haven't been able to find those kinds of lasting, you know, impacts, I guess.
All right. Well, let's talk about the legacy today, because now that people are paying attention to this story and learning about Buxton, what do you think the impact of that is now?
Yeah. You know, I think with right now, with everything's going on and everything feeling so, people feeling so divided, you know, our country being divided, it's like Buxton seems to be this, I feel like there's a sense of nostalgia. There's a sense of, you know, why can't we do what we did there? And some, to some extent, it is romanticizing, I think, a little bit, in that we know it's not perfect. But there is that feeling of, you know, they were able to do it at a time then where conditions were much worse than they are in the U.S. today. You know, let's do that again. So there does seem to be that feeling in people that I, you know, that I talk to. Right.
Is it events. Frustrating, though, to think, why can't we accomplish this now?
I think it's frustrating also just that, you know, that it didn't make a bigger impact then as well. And yes, I think to a certain extent, there are lessons that we can learn from Buxton, you know, in terms of why it was successful, you know, and that it had, you had leadership who was saying this is not acceptable, you know, that, you know, racism and division and such is not acceptable. You had people who had the same opportunities. So I think that was it.
You have invested so much time and an effort in collecting these stories, in preserving this history. You've done a great deal to make sure that those oral histories that were really at risk are going to be preserved. And I'm curious about what you hope to do in the future with this story.
Well, to be honest, I'm actually working on preservation of the site itself. It's still in the early stages, but I had permission from the Monroe County Historical Society who maintains the land, and the farmer who owns the land, he's not farming it anymore, but to see what we can do to preserve it. And I have had an architect kind of draw up some plans of what it could look like. Rod Curtis of Curtis Design did that for me for free. And I have someone who's interested in maybe helping to donate some funding to this. So the point is, it's still in the early stages. I can't give specifics, but that's my big project now, is
wow.
Seeing what we can do to preserve this, put a museum there, you know, make it accessible to people to come and learn the history of Buxton.
Well, thank you for coming from California to save Buxton for us, Rochelle. You also, as you mentioned, you were writing romance novels when you first learned about Buxton, Iowa, before
yep.
This sort of took over your brain. You also want to write a novel that takes place in Buxton?
I do. I want to write. It's not going to be a romance. It's going to be more of a, I think it's going to be an alternative historical fiction book set in Buxton. So I'm working on that. I'm hoping to get at least the proposal and everything done in the next couple of weeks, I should say month. And then I really would like to get that done this year.
You've also been doing a lot of traveling and talking about Buxton. Why
yeah.
do you think people are so hungry for this story right now?
I like to think it's the same reason that I am. It's just an unbelievable story that it existed at the time that it did, and it was so progressive for that time period. And it existed here in Iowa, again, at a time when the, you know, the population was pretty much 99.2%, you know, white or foreign born. And so I think there's just this sense of just amazement that it existed, and this sense of pride that it existed here, you know, in Iowa.
Well, Rochelle Chase, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you. And check out LostBuxton.com.
All right.
As well.
You've got a whole community, people who are excited about Buxton and sharing stories and sharing photos and so much more to learn. Rochelle, thank you.
Thank you.
Rochelle Chase, her latest book is also about Buxton, Iowa. It's called Creating the Black Utopia of Buxton, Iowa. And you can check out her website, LostBuxton.com. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio. You never have to miss a show. Please subscribe to our Talk of Iowa podcast, wherever you get your podcasts. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.